Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. If you've been listening long enough, you might know that from time to time we are visited by my cousin, Tom Stella. He's written several books over the years, and when one family member is a writer of books on spirituality, and another is the host of a program that deals with all things religious and spiritual, well, you get the idea. Tom Stella was ordained a Catholic priest in the Order of the Holy Cross in the early 1970s. He now serves as a chaplain for Centura Health, a collaboration between the Catholic Church and Seventh-day Adventists in Colorado that manages hospitals and other healthcare facilities. He has extensive experience in the realm of spiritual direction, retreat programming, and counseling in both hospital and hospice environments. He is the director of Soul Link, a nonprofit whose mission is to create opportunities for spiritual seekers to meet and facilitate one another's growth. He is the author of 5 books: The God Instinct, A Faith Worth Believing, Finding God Beyond Religion, CPR for the Soul, and the book we'll discuss today, In Sync with the Sacred, Out of Step with the World. So, I'm very pleased to welcome to Common Threads, once again, my cousin, Tom Stella. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Fred. Nice to be with you all.
Yes, yes, it always is. So, first question, where do you think that this book that we're talking about today, In Sync with the Sacred, Out of Step with the World, where does it fit in your canon so far? Where does it go above and beyond or sideways of the previous 4?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think most of the previous books focused on a way of understanding religious truths, teachings that may no longer work for people, may have outgrown them. But so I try to give a different understanding, a different spin, a spiritual take on the religious teachings. This book is more of a sense of what happens to us when we yield to that inner truth, that spiritual truth that I think all of us have at the essence of ourselves, our soul. When we honor that voice within, how does that call us to live? And I think, as the title suggests, Out of Step with the World, it usually calls us to be out of sync with the teachings or the conventional wisdom of our culture. And I think that's true in every religious tradition. You know, for a Christian, if we're true to the gospel, if we're Jewish, if we're true to the Torah, if we're Muslim, if we're true to the Quran, etc., they will all take us in a direction that's probably other than the culture. So that's what I try to give some insight into in this book.
You comment, you write about your previous thoughts on life. You refer to it as a proving ground of sorts, putting you at the eternal dessert table after death or being burnt to a crisp. And you talk about this this understanding in your seminary days, and I was quite surprised. When you were in seminary, was that the theology that you were taught, the whole idea of eternal separation from God, hellfire, etc.? Because, you know, you were in your seminary days in the late 60s, early 70s, and I thought that the church had sort of moved away from that kind of thinking, but perhaps they didn't.
No, actually, the seminary education was much more progressive. I think what I was referring to when I talked about the world as a proving ground, that was early upbringing. That was pre-Vatican II Catholicism, which, you know, I was the air I breathed. And having been raised in the 50s and 60s, so that when I went into the seminary, it was really fortunate timing in the sense that Vatican II was just taking place, which really kind of blew apart some of the traditional understandings of Catholic Christianity. and open the windows and the doors to some fresh air, some ecumenical fresh air. So anyway, I was referring to a time prior to the seminary.
Okay, that makes much more sense.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that evolution of thought, because you were really on the ground there in grade school, high school, college, and then in seminary. I'm assuming you did see an evolution of thought in terms of afterlife. What was that like?
Well, I was very much a traditional Catholic growing up. And it was, the afterlife was what it was all about. You know, this is where you proved that you were worthy of that dessert table in heaven. And then during the seminary years, it was a powerful transition to a broader, more open-minded understanding that what I was taught, I think I could say we for most people in my generation, we were taught about the afterlife was had nothing much to do with this life except in terms of what we earned our way into heaven. Now, the understanding is the more deeply we enter into this life, the more in touch we are with that which we were taught was only for later. One way of talking about that is with regard to prayer. For instance, in the Baltimore Catechism, which was bigger than the Bible, really, when you're growing up Catholic, definition of prayer was lifting your mind and your heart to God. Now, to truly live prayerfully is to engage the world, is to deeply enter into the everydayness of life, wherein we are likely to stumble upon the divinity of that life.
You say that dessert is being served every day. I think this is a natural progression from what you're saying right now. Dessert is being served every day. It's not something that one waits for. But you also say, you qualify that, as are the not-so-tasty veggies. I didn't know your mother could make anything not wonderful.
She didn't.
Okay. You're talking about the rest of us. For those who are not aware, his mother, my godmother, was just a legendary cook in the family. And we had a lot of legendary cooks, but she had a special place, especially in the Detroit constituency of the Stellas. It's interesting, too, in Chapter 1, you write about how you didn't always measure up in school, family, sports, etc. And I have this vague memory of us having this conversation around one of your previous books, but I'm going to bring it up again because it's been ages. Were you aware that you and your brother Michael were the bar that was set for me?
I remember you saying that.
Yeah. It was just interesting.
I wasn't conscious of it at the time, but...
Yeah. Right. But it is interesting that you felt you didn't measure up in school, which to me is a revelation. My brother Mark and I, were just brought up to believe that between the both of you, you hit every single mark that could be met by a young man. But you say that you didn't quite hit every mark, huh?
Not at all. I had you fooled.
You had my dad fooled.
I had your dad fooled. Your father, my godfather, was a wonderful, wonderful person and a wonderful uncle and a wonderful role model.
Yes, absolutely.
And, I think all of us, when we are honest with ourselves, you know, we are in touch with our less than ideal self. And so I was very much conscious of that as I went through my younger days, and I can say now that all of that imperfection is still there. I just have a more compassionate attitude toward myself.
You know, it's interesting, too, about the book, that as someone who has read all of your books, In this one, you really open up more than in any other book, and you're not afraid at all to show the shadow side. Can you tell us a little bit about that process and how it worked into the book?
Well, you're not the first person to tell me that. And I was certainly aware as I was writing it that I was trying to be very personal. And I think it's the fruit of having wonderful spiritual directors throughout my life, you know, which I continue to this day to have, and wonderful friends who were capable of affirming me, though they knew that darker side, that shadow side. And so as I became more and more comfortable with not being the perfect person I wished I had been, it became much easier to just use personal examples as I was making points I'm making in this book. So I like to think, anyway, that the growth is not so much overcoming that in us which we feel should not be there as it is becoming comfortable with its being there. So that and that made it very easy to just be very personal in the book.
One thing that you mentioned that I was not aware, I know you do several things, but you're giving talks now, or you have given talks to businesses about spirituality in the workplace. Is that something that is still constant?
It's not as constant as it once was. But you know, still periodically, yes. And spirituality in the workplace is, I think, a powerful concept. One of my jobs now is with a health system that is both Catholic and Adventist. So it's faith-based, but I'm a chaplain for their, not in the hospitals that they sponsored, but in the workplace where their support staff, people sitting in cubes looking at computers all day, they have a chaplain. They have me to refer to talk to, and I have them. It's a wonderful reciprocal ministry.
And you say that in the book also, well, before I actually ask this question, I want to remind people that you're listening to WGVU. The show is Common Threads. My name is Fred Stella, and I'm talking with my cousin Tom Stella about his latest book, In Sync with the Sacred, Out of Step with the World. You talk about giving lectures to groups, and you have to deal with people who are somewhat resistant to being there. Apparently, this was not an elective activity, that it was something for everyone. Talk about the challenge of speaking to people who don't really want to be there. And do you ever have an experience where someone walks in with a frustration, I don't want to be here, but walks out with something, a bit more appreciation for what spirituality can be?
Well, I wish there was more of that. And it's not as if people's arms are being twisted to be present at a presentation that I might be giving, but especially when it's workplace related, I think a lot of people, and if the event is taking place in the workplace as opposed to, for instance, at a retreat center somewhere. And, you know, people are bringing their phones, they're bringing their consciousness of what they could be and should be doing. And so their presence is kind of not fully mindful. And I think with some, if there's any kind of openness, they realize that there may be some benefit to them for taking time away from their desk to be in a presentation and discussion that has to do with their personal spiritual lives. I understand it when there's resistance to that, but I wouldn't say it's any kind of dramatic resistance. It's more just the challenge to me is to, in a sense, prove to them that what I have to say is worthwhile and related not only to their life apart from work, but at work.
My next question, then, it should be obvious to you. Why didn't you do something like this at Stella Products? You could have teamed up teamed up with Ann Kligowski, it would have been a game changer, Tom. A game changer.
Yeah. Well, obviously your listeners aren't fully tuned into this, but the family business, which I do refer to in the book, was hardly a place where you would imagine spirituality to be a dimension of it.
But for those of us who were a part of the family business, it is just an absolute powerful segment of our lives. So very quickly, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but our fathers, Tom's and mine, along with one other uncle, were partners in a restaurant design and equipment company in Detroit. And if you were a Stella of that next generation, as we were, you just knew you never had to look for a job as a kid. You could, but you didn't have to, because there was always an opening in the warehouse or some other place at Stella Products. And I don't know about you, Tom, but when I think back to my Stella Products days, I think back with more nostalgia than I do high school. It was really a powerful time, because I got a chance to know all of my cousins and my uncles in a way that I wouldn't otherwise. But we definitely, our souls were tried in several ways there. There's no question about that.
Yeah, no, I was proud to be a part of that. And Stella Products was a presence in Detroit, I think, in a lot of ways, partly through our Uncle Frank, who was involved in many civic and endeavors and beyond Detroit as well. But I was proud of the Stella name.
Yeah, no question. No question. You talk about the benefits of being in a dark mood. And I can understand that. My question is, though, what about interacting with other people? If you are in a dark mood and you are attempting to find any benefit in it, isn't it a challenge, though, for the rest of us to be with Mr. or Ms. Cranky Pants when they're going through that? And can you offer us an ability to be in that dark mood without infecting others?
Mm-hmm. Well, what you're referring to is the poem "The Guest House" by Rumi.
Yes.
That I quote in the book.
Yes.
And Rumi talks about being open to dark visitors. You know, those moods that can take us to a not so pleasant place, which are just part of our humanity. And I think in relationship, if I happen to be in that kind of place in myself, a down mood or whatever, and yet I'm interacting with people, sometimes if it seems appropriate, the best thing is to do is to name it. Say, you know, folks, I'm not at my best today, but, you know, try to be present to you. And I think that kind of honesty can cut through some of that, what could be a kind of negativity. And by dark moods, I just mean, you know, the kind of, you know, I might be angry at somebody or have some kind of pettiness going on, or fears, things that, you know, I wish weren't there, but they're there. And to the degree that we resist them, I think they take a more solid hold on us. So kind of going with the flow of them, this too shall pass, you know, that kind of notion. So that's the way I try to deal with it. If I'm not at my best, but yet I'm interacting with people.
And what is the metaphor of the one piece puzzle that you write about?
Yeah, that notion came to me as I was speaking with a woman, and I say this in the book, and she was talking about how wonderful she felt about a graduate program she had started, even though there were other elements of her life, her family, parenting, that were still a responsibility for her. And yet she was saying, I wish all of that other stuff would go away and I could just focus on school. That to me is like saying, I wish my life was a one-piece puzzle, only consisting of those things that I value and enjoy the most. And I think that is, you know, that's understandable healthy, even instinct. I know I have it in myself. I wish I always was able to just do those things I enjoyed doing. But the fact is, that's not life. And this is one of the things that comes up several times in the book. And I mentioned in the introduction that there might be some redundancy, what people will read in this book. And one of those redundant elements is that we can want our life to be something other than what it is. But as the Buddhists say, that's the definition of suffering, to resist reality. So I present that as part of this being in sync with the sacred, because when we are in sync with that deeper self, I think we flow more easily with those elements of our lives that we wish weren't there.
It's interesting you mentioned redundancy, because I have read that oftentimes redundancy is the mark of a great revelation. I don't know if you're aware of that, but you've got one mark on your side at least.
Well, that's good to know.
Yes.
I do think, and I say this, I hope that it just reinforces the importance more than just redundancy and, you know, saying it again in a different way. It's like, no, it's really important, so it comes up again and again.
One thing that I came upon in the book that I have no memory of, maybe I knew it back then, but long since forgotten. You talk about a fact-finding trip in Chile in the 1980s. You don't go into detail about it. I think your mention of being there was tangential to making another point. But since I have you here, what were you doing? What facts were you finding in the 1980s in Chile?
Mm. Well, I was in Chile with a group from Notre Dame. And it was in the middle of Pinochet's rule there. And we were going there to get a read on how his presence and his regime was impacting especially the folks on the margins. And there was a group of students there that I was involved with, who were doing 2 years of volunteer service in the poorer districts, the poblaciones of Santiago. So I was going to check up on them to see how they were doing, but also to, again, get a read on the effect of Pinochet's regime. And we would interview people whose children had disappeared. You know? So just kind of really getting the nitty-gritty sense for what it's like to live in that kind of dictatorship.
Were any of your colleagues endangered?
No, there was a group actually of Holy Cross religious who, there are two schools in Santiago, one in the inner city and the other is a very kind of elite school. So some of the faculty there were Holy Cross people that I knew. And some eventually, I think it was a little bit after that, sort of got out by the skin of their teeth, where they started cracking down on priests and parishes that were being encouraging the rights of the poor. So, yes, it was not a pleasant time.
I can imagine. If you will, you mentioned a few minutes ago, when you were talking, you were essentially thanking certain people, acknowledging certain people who helped you progress in life. And you mentioned your spiritual directors. You had one relationship, a spiritual director that you write about in the book, and he was a priest, and he was a Jesuit priest, and he was gay. And I'm just curious, what did you take out of that particular relationship with a spiritual director? And in your answer, how out was he as a gay man, if he was out at all?
Well, yeah, Joe was a wonderful guy, psychologist as well as a priest. As I mentioned in the book, too, he was so comfortable in his own skin that it was hard to be in his presence without being comfortable with who you were. Who I was. Joe was not a flaming gay person by any means. It was just a sort of a subtle dimension of himself that he became more and more comfortable with. And I think the effect of that was that because Joe was comfortable with who he was in the eyes of God, it made me more comfortable with my own ambivalence about being who I was. And that ambivalence had to do, it was a time of struggle for me with regard to whether or not I really was doing the right thing with my life in terms of remaining a priest. And again, Joe made me just comfortable with asking the questions. You know, it's a good question. It's an important question. And he helped me to kind of just walk through the middle of that.
Wonderful. Tom, we are out of time for this episode of Common Threads, but plenty more questions for you about this book. So I'm hoping we can continue this next week.
Look forward to it.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. My name is Fred Stella, and with me today has been my cousin Tom Stella, who's the author of the book In Sync with the Sacred, Out of Step with the World. And please join us next week as we continue our conversation here on WGVU-FM.